Thank you, Senator Stevenson. I'm very grateful for the privilege and honor of being here with you today. By way of disclaimer, let me say that my views I express today are my own and not necessarily those of my employer, and any criticism I may lodge towards the federal government excludes Utah's Washington delegation, because if every state had a delegation as good as ours, I wouldn't need to be addressing the subject I'm about to today. For the past 3.5 decades, I've had the privilege, as Howard said, of assisting state and local governments around the nation, but principally here in my native state of Utah, to raise monies to finance the governmental facilities and services they provide their citizens. While assisting those state and local governments, I've witnessed how local government works up close and firsthand, and how important the American system to the American system of government is state and local government. I've been very impressed by the fiscal restraint and responsibility that's been exercised by the state and local government officials and their citizens as they downsize or even reject projects that they think are too big, too expensive, too premature, or just plain unnecessary. I've appreciated that as a citizen, even when, as a lawyer, it meant a reduction or elimination of my legal fee. Often I even voted for that when it meant a reduction of my fee. That kind of responsibility and restraint has made Utah famous, has made the debt ratios of many of Utah's communities some of the lowest in the nation's, has given many of Utah's communities lower borrowing costs than others in the nation enjoy, and that's saved a lot of money for the governments and the taxpayers. And it has made the local economy, as you know better than I do, more robust than economies in many other states. That kind of local influence and control over local sovereign government by local governmental officials and citizens is one of the key features that makes the American system of government unique, and it was one of the key instigators and igniters of the rebellion, as you know, that ripened into the American War of Independence. You all know better than I do this history, but to put into perspective what I'd like to say, let me mention just a couple of salient points about our country's birth. Because of their British heritage and their distance and remoteness from the centralized national government thousands of miles away in London, ever since the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock in 1620, American colonists had been exercising the kind of local control over local government by local citizens that we've been discussing. The American colonists levied, collected, and spent their own local taxes for their own governmental activities to finance things like roads and bridges and canals and to pay salaries of officials like mayors, governors, and judges. The American colonists understood the golden rule that whoever controls the levying, collection, and expenditure of the local government's gold controls the local government. They understood the economic and political reality that the power to tax is the power to control or destroy. So when in the early 1770s, the centralized governmental parliament thousands of miles away in London tried to levy local taxes on the American colonists for the first time, which would take away from the colonists that local control and give it to parliament, the colonists naturally resisted vehemently. What's interesting is that the American patriots weren't protesting the amount or size of the new parliamentary taxes. They were actually relatively small if you look at them. It wasn't the size that so outraged them. It was who was levying, collecting, and spending those taxes, and thus taking control over the local government activities that were paid thereby, the parliament. Parliament offered to reduce them. The colonists said no. Parliament offered to put a colonial representative in the parliament. The colonists said no. A representative thousands of miles away in the centralized government in London isn't going to be like local officials that we can elect and unelect and that live with us in our own backyards. So the Americans fought back. And by winning what turned into the War of Independence, the American patriots maintained the control over local government that they had been exercising for more than 150 years since Plymouth Rock. When the new Constitution was adopted after they won that war, it's interesting that the Constitution did not create that local control over local government by local citizens. It merely maintained and memorialized it in the Constitution's central feature, the separation of powers between the states on the one hand and the new federal government they were creating by adopting the Constitution on the other hand. As you know better than I do, that separation of powers was so important to the states and to the people that many of them refused to ratify the new Constitution until they could be assured that a Bill of Rights would be added, the last provision of which, the 10th Amendment, guaranteed and protected that separation of powers between the states and the federal government. The Supreme Court enforced that separation of powers for 200 years, Lord bless them. They ruled that the states couldn't tax activities of the federal government in their states, and they ruled that the federal government could not tax interest on monies borrowed by state and local governments to finance their governmental activities, because the power of either to tax the activities of the other would be the power to control the other. And the Supreme Court said the power to tax is the power to destroy. So federal government, thou shalt not tax interest paid by state and local governments on monies they borrow through the issuance of municipal bonds to fund their local activities, because that would give you the power to control those activities. That went on for 200 years. But in 1985, a day I'll always remember with infamy, in the Garcia case, the U.S. Supreme Court announced that it was effectively abandoning and abdicating its duty to abide by and to enforce the Constitution's separation of powers, and that from then on, states would have to effectively look only to the national political process to protect them from encroachments into their constitutionally protected powers by the national government. That was like saying that from then on, the chickens would have to look to the fox solely for protection from the fox. And I ask you, how well has that worked? Then 3 years later, in 1988, the Supreme Court compounded its error and its abdication to enforce the separation of powers in Baker v. South Carolina when it ruled that the 200-year-old exemption from taxation for interest on municipal bonds was no longer founded on the Constitution's separation of powers and the 10th Amendment, but all of a sudden it was a gift from Congress. And we all know that what Congress giveth, Congress can take away. That was an untruth then. It's still an untruth today. But repeat an untruth often enough, and people begin to believe it. So in a startling example of rewriting the Constitution by creatively interpreting a central position almost out of the Constitution, the Supreme Court left the door wide open for the federal government to come and assume unprecedented control over state and local governments by beginning to tax the interest you pay on the monies you borrow to finance your activities. And now today, Congress is finally threatening to burst through that door. Today, many members in Congress are threatening to abolish what's now a 229-year-old exemption from federal taxation of interest on municipal bonds and replacing it with direct subsidies to be paid by the federal government to the state and local governments, as may be approved from time to time by Congress. Imagine the control and influence that will give over your activities to the federal government. Imagine what blandishments that will allow the government, federal government, to waive, and what pressures it will allow the federal government to put on state and local governments and citizens to fund projects that the federal government wants that state and local officials and taxpayers might never touch. All this by a federal government that never saw a project it didn't like, never saw a project that was too big, too expensive, too premature, or unnecessary, and a federal government that couldn't recognize a balanced budget if it ever saw one. Imagine how unfunded mandates where federal government co-opts people into projects they wouldn't touch by funding some of the upfront costs and then leaving the states and local governments high and dry to foot the bill from then on. Imagine how those unfunded mandates will proliferate if this ever happens. Many fiscally responsible states, like Utah, will be able to kiss their balanced budgets and healthy economies goodbye. Utah will become more like those paragons of fiscal responsibility, California and Illinois. Because those who lend monies to state and local governments will have to pay tax, they're going to raise the rates that they put on the borrowings. That's going to raise state and local government's cost of doing business immediately. It's going to raise taxes, state and local taxes, that taxpayers are going to have to pay immediately, significantly, and forever. But even worse than that, if there can be anything worse, is that the influence and control over state and local government activities that abolishing taxation for municipal bonds will place in the hands of the federal government will merely be one giant leap towards the avowed goal that I've heard from many in Washington myself of transforming state and local governments from the separate political entities, legal, governmental entities that they are, into mere subdivisions of and controlled by the federal government. The local influence and control over sovereign government that I have as a citizen is a constitutionally guaranteed personal right that I'm not willing to give up. The American patriots in 1776 weren't willing to give it up, and they fought a war to preserve it. What are we willing to do? What can we do? If past history has taught us anything, it's taught us that we can no longer look to the fox for protection from the fox. No instrumentality of the federal government, not the president, the Congress, or the Supreme Court, will ever stop the federal government from continually usurping rights and powers reserved to the states under the Constitution. So who's left? Who better to stop changes to the Constitution by those who aren't authorized to change it than the only ones who are authorized to approve changes to the Constitution? Our state legislatures. That's why I've researched and drafted an amendment to the Constitution in the form of a resolution that would be adopted by state legislatures requesting Congress to call a targeted convention for state legislative delegates solely for the purpose of considering and proposing this amendment, which the states could then ratify it if they approve it. The amendment would do basically four things. It would reaffirm and instruct the Supreme Court to start again abiding by and enforcing the Constitution's separation of powers and the Tenth Amendment. Second, it would reaffirm that tax exemption is based on that separation of powers and not any act of Congress. Third, it would stop changes to the Constitution by those not authorized to change it by giving power to the only ones who are authorized to change it, a supermajority of state legislatures, power to review and overturn any act or decision of a federal government official that would violate the Constitution. And finally, it would authorize state legislatures to propose directly amendments without a need for a convention. So this targeted amendment convention would be the last time such a convention would be necessary for state legislatures to propose an amendment. There are some who fear that such an amendment convention, even a targeted one like the one I'm proposing, might pose a threat to the Constitution itself. That reminds me of the parents who forbid life-saving surgery for their mortally sick child because they fear the complications that might result from the life-saving surgery. They're missing the fact that if the child doesn't have the surgery, the child is certainly going to die. If Congress, the President, and the Supreme Court are allowed to continue changing the Constitution as they have been, do we even have a Constitution, or do we have a mere suggestion that the President, Congress, and the Supreme Court feel that they can ignore and change at will any way they want, any time they want? The Constitution needs to be restored as the highest law of the land. Its inviolability should not depend on who controls the Congress or the presidency or the Supreme Court. It needs to be the highest law of the land, whoever's in office. So I've given copies of my proposed amendment to the Utah Taxpayers Association, if any of you are interested, and I thank you so much for all you do and for the time. Thank you.